Number one, Star Wars. Number two, comics. Number three, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number four, Mario. Number five, Weird Al. Number six, Batman. Number seven, Kal-El. Number eight, The Simpsons. Number nine, TV. Number ten, every single band that I stole all their MP3s, but before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Nerds ruin everything. Say nerds ruin everything.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Nerds Ruin Everything. I'm Logan.
And I'm Adam.
And we're going to talk about a little bit more about Bad Boys for sure this week. It's been 2 weeks. It's made a decent amount of money, so I feel like a lot of people have seen it. We're also going to talk about Bratz, which we both watched this week. Not The Boys, although I do want to briefly talk a little bit, not spoilery, but just about The Boys as a show in general. I know you haven't caught up to it.
No, but I've heard I've seen the rancor that's been going around, and I can't, like, we can at least have a talk, like, we'll get to it, of course. But,
and let's see, what else? Oh, House of the Dragon, which you don't watch. I watched the premiere of that.
Yes.
But first, I want to ask you, have you seen and or heard of a movie called Maggie Moores?
No, neither. I've not heard about this.
Okay, so I watched Bratz the other night on Hulu.
Yes.
And then I kind of got stuck in a, like, I don't spend too much time, like, flipping around on Hulu. I usually just turn it on to watch what I know is on Hulu. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's destination, not like, oh, let me see what's on Hulu. So, yeah. I went to my recommended things, and it's like, because you watched XYZ on Hulu, you might like this. And I forget why this was recommended to me, but I think it was because of Only Murders in the Building.
Okay.
There is this movie called Maggie Moore. But there's an S at the end of it, and the S is in the, in a, like, the parentheses. So it's Maggie Moore, parentheses S. So the movie is written by a guy named Paul Birnbaum, who I'm not real familiar with, but, like, he wrote Next, the Nicolas Cage movie.
Oh, yeah.
that was, like, his previous thing before this movie. Like, that was his last screenplay. And this movie came out last year. I don't know if it actually got a theatrical release. But the I watched the trailer for it and was immediately like, I think I got to watch this because it stars Jon Hamm, Tina Fey, and Nick Mohammed. And it's directed by John Slattery. The John Slattery from Mad Men.
I'm watching, like, I've heard of it. Like, I didn't realize I know this film. Like, I've seen the trailer for it. And it, like, yes, I know of this film now. So you took a dive. Like, that cast alone. That cast alone, John.
Yeah,
Hamm,
those
TFA,
three people with him directing
is
interesting enough. The trailer looked unique enough, but also something, yes, like Hulu thinks I might like. Very much Only Murders in the Building. So it's about this woman, Maggie Moore, who gets murdered. Like, they find her body, like, in a car, burnt to a crisp. And he's, Jon Hamm's the chief of police. He's investigating. Nick Mohammed is his right-hand deputy. So, they're investigating this murder, and another woman named Maggie Moore also gets murdered. I will say, if you watch the trailer, it gives away the murderer.
Oh,
the whole, but that's not the driving force of the movie. It's not a mystery. Like, 10 minutes into the movie, you know who did it. Like, there's just no question. It's mostly just about John Hamm. He's a widowed sheriff, and he starts investigating this murder, and he kind of falls for the next door neighbor, played by Tina Fey, and it's weird, and I can see why the movie didn't really make a splash in any way, shape, or form, because it's all over the place. Like, it's a comedy, it's a crime procedural, it's a little dramatic, it's romantic, it, you know, like, there's a lot of grisly stuff in it. Not gory, just grisly. You see the death. You don't see them kill these characters, but you see the aftermath of it, and it's very just like, ugh. But it's really good.
Huh. Like, it's like a, like what we're getting this year in the theaters, which is like a hodgepodge mess of films, right? Like, they're overstuffed. Like, it's overstuffed with ideas. Some that don't work, but some that really do. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it sounds like it's an intriguing movie that continues to, like, get you to watch because of it. Because it's not that it's a bad movie. It's just an overstuffed movie.
Yeah, I don't even know if it's overstuffed. It just doesn't know what it wants to be. So much so that there is a character that dies toward the end of the movie that I was like shocked because it didn't feel like it was that kind of movie. Like, most of the death early on in the movie is kind of like, it's grisly, but it's also played kind of funny. And then somebody bites it, and it's just like, oh shit. Like, the stakes are real for all of these people. And we've just kind of been like, isn't it funny that, like, maybe, you know, they killed somebody and they weren't supposed to, or it's kind of Coen-esque.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, is that, like, it sounds like Slattery has an affection for the Coens. Like, the only problem is that, like, the Coen brothers are truly, like, you know, like, they've perfected their style.
I don't think they would have, like, so the Big Lebowski is a good example of, like, a character dies in that movie.
Donnie, man. Spoiler for a 30-year-old movie.
And it is kind of upsetting, but they never play the drama of it. They always play into the like, absurdity of it.
Yeah.
So,
but life is a wild-ass joke, but it's a very dark joke. Like, I used to hate, like, did I ever tell you that I used to hate that movie? Like, I actively hated it as soon as Donnie died.
That's funny. The first, I don't know, probably two or three times, because everybody kept telling me to watch that movie, probably... Oh. Like, right out of high school, or maybe in high school.
It would have been, because it came out in 97, it would have been right in high school.
Yeah, senior year of high school. Yeah, mm-hmm. Everybody would tell me to watch it. And probably for the first two or three years of existence,
you didn't watch it.
I would try to watch it.
Yeah.
With people who were like, you got to watch it, it's so funny. And I just didn't get it, man. Like, I didn't get it. And at some point, like, I came to it of my, like, own accord. And I was like, okay. It's probably after Oh Brother.
That makes sense.
I went back and started watching Coen movies. And I was like, okay. Like, I think I get it now. Like, I didn't really get Fargo either. The only movie I kind of liked of theirs before Oh Brother was Raising Arizona.
Yeah. But that's not even, like, a real unlocking, right? Like, there's always a Coen Brothers movie that unlocks you to their work if you're akin to it, right? They're always, like, the big ones. But I don't feel like everybody likes True Grit. Everybody likes Raising Arizona. But it's kind of like weird to like when you first see something from the Coens, sometimes it's like outright rejection. Like we saw it earlier this year with the what part like, you know, one half of the Coen brothers with Drive Away Doll. I honestly feel like that movie is going to come back and whip people in the face because it's so much fun. It's such a like it's such a weird Lee Cohen-esque movie. But getting back to this, Maggie Moore's, it brings up something that's very interesting because I just recently read a quote from a larger article and I got to go back to it about John Hamm. And John Hamm, like, just basically saying, like, you know, like, y'all want me to be, like, you know, I'm not Don Draper. Like, that was a character I played. And after it, I want to explore other things, and you guys are trying to make me not do that. Like, see, you guys just want me to play Don Draper.
It's funny. I didn't watch Mad Men. I still have never seen Mad Men. So the John Hamm that I know is the
other John Hamm. The
Good Omens. This Confess Fletch.
Bridesmaids.
Yeah. Well, actually, I've never seen Bridesmaids.
Oh, you've never seen Bridesmaids? Oh, okay.
No. Okay. The goofier stuff, you know, like he shows up on the Tina Fey show, right? Don't they date?
Oh, 30 Rock.
Yeah. Doesn't he show up on 30 Rock?
Yeah, he's one of her people. The
captain. Yeah. I was like, everybody else is in this movie because of John Slattery. It's not a huge cast, but like, John Hamm's definitely in it because of John Slattery.
But Tina Fey's
Tina Fey's in it because of John Hamm. he did this small show called The Increasingly Poor Decisions of Todd Margaret that is
never heard of this fucking show.
Oh, you've got to watch this. Will Arnett, David Cross, it was a BBC show. It's fucking hysterical.
Okay. I will seek it out. I'm putting it on my list right now.
He's only in about 5 episodes. Okay. But I remember watching that. It was either like right after Mad Men or at the tail end of Mad Men. Mm-hmm. And being like, this is the guy that's like the like super serious, suave, debonair ad guy in Mad Men. Like, I don't buy it. Like, but that's because when I first see him, he's this like real goofball kind of character. So like the John Hamm that almost everybody wants him to be, I don't know. I only know like the goofier side of it. So
we see it occasionally like in Top Gun Maverick.
But
that's like supporting roles, right? Like if you've not seen Mad Men, it doesn't make sense, right? Like, or even the Morning Show. From what I understand, the Morning Show is a little bit more on point with, like, not Don Draper, but Don Draper adjacent, which I always find funny. I do like him. Like, I like when he gets with, like, guys that want to take his image and kind of skew it. Like, Edgar Wright did it a great job of, like, giving him that kind of, like, that kind of role in Baby Driver. If you had remembered him in Baby Driver, he's a very small role, but it's like, or even like one of my favorite movies of the last like 10 years, Bad Times at the El Royale. Like he plays a kind of like the image of it, but like his role in that movie is very not Don Draper-esque, right? It's like this FBI agent. It's interesting what he's done with all, like, you know, because he's basically gotten a free, with Mad Men, he's gotten a free check, right? Like, even if it gets bad, he can always go back to Matthew Weiner, who made Mad Men, and say, let's do the 80s years. Let's have Don Draper go back, because like that's what everybody wants, right? Like, they made it up to the 60s, 70s, and, like, you know, it ends. But, you know, it's like, well, the 80s is something that could totally be done. But anywho, but I'm with you. I like John Hamm as a Muppet. Like that's what I always call him. Like, whenever I see him in goofy roles, he reminds me of, like, a real-life Muppet. He doesn't look like a real person. Like, he looks like a Muppet that wished himself to be a real-life person.
Yeah, like, you should definitely track down Todd Margaret. I really think you'll love him in that. Like I said, he's only in a handful of episodes, but it's very, very, very funny. He kind of toes the line with this show. Like, he does the, like, goofy charm thing, but also the super serious dramatic thing. Like I said, it's not overstuffed. It just doesn't really know what it wants to be. And it's kind of trying to be all of it. And it all works. It's just kind of, like, jarring at times. But, like, I really, really enjoyed it. And it would... would have kind of made for a fun, like, series. Like, John Hamm is this, like, small town sheriff kind of investigating crime.
Or like Fletch, if they had ever gotten, like, like that's the stupidest decision I think that they ever made. Like, you have fucking Greg Mottola directing a Fletch movie. Why are you having Greg Mottola, the guy who does TV, like, he's like the equivalent of like, I don't even know who you could compare him to, but
it should
like,
have been a series. Like,
it really,
like,
should have been
Fletch as a Apple Plus, like, you know,
with John Slattery as his editor. Are you fucking kidding me? Like, I like, that's catnip. And then every, like, it becomes their murderers in the building, right? Because you get, like, you can get, like, some really great, like, talent to just show up for a season just to do something, right?
Yeah, but between the two of those guys, like, you could get a shit ton of people. Like, John Hamm can pull almost anybody at this point. So,
absolutely. Like, and then Slattery, I mean, Slattery is just that guy that, like, everybody loves. Like, he is truly one, like outside of, like, you know, outside of geekdom, right? He's that guy that everybody kind of points to and says, like, I really like this older dude. Even though he's probably just as old as Hamm, he just has allowed himself to age. Like, Slattery is that guy that gives you, I don't know, a bit of class, a bit of, like, it ups things. Like, it makes sense that he's Tony's dad. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he's the guy with a single look that can make somebody like RDJ kind of not cower, but stand at attention, right? Like that's what I love about him, is that he has this responsible adult presence that can be fucked around with. Like, there's a very infamous Mad Men episode, and I feel like everybody has seen it. It's the drug episode, but it's because it's not Draper that makes it funny. It's John Slattery's character that makes it funny, because he is so buttoned up, right? He is such a, like buttoned up kind of type that when you see him loose, it's kind of hilarious. And, like, people have done that with him, like, over the last, like, 10 years. And it's kind of, like, great. But it's also, he always keeps his, like, he always feels like he's an editor, like, a chief of police. Like, he always feels like he's somebody in authority. You know who he reminds me of? Like, late era, either Boyd Holbrook or Jason Robards.
Yeah.
Like if they were to remake The Paper, it would either be him or Michael Keaton that would be playing the editor, right? Because, like they have that energy. Like, it's always that kind of energy. Like, though, Keaton feels like the dude that shows up in shorts, and Slattery is the dude that always shows up in a suit, even if it's, like, an all-white seersucker suit. He, in the middle of summer, he's going to show up in a suit. Like, I just kind of love him. I love, like his... There's just certain guys that you just kind of, like, when you watch a movie and they fucking show up, and you're like, yes, this is going to be okay. Like, it may be not the best thing, but he's showing up, it's going to be okay. So, yeah. I'm going to have to definitely check this out.
Yeah, I think you'd enjoy it. for sure. Okay. And it's a, especially if you have Hulu, like if you have the real plan without commercials, yeah. it's a breezy watch. Like it's pretty easy. It's pretty compelling. But you know, that aside, we did both watch something on Hulu this week, and that's Bratz.
Yes. Okay. So, I don't know what your thoughts were. I texted you my thoughts as they were, like, as I was watching. Like, there were a couple of things that I felt about it very strongly. But I'm actually, because, like, of the two of us, like, you and Ryan, you're the guys of the dudes that are, like, the Brat Pack dudes. And so, like, I'm very curious about what your thoughts are on this, like, I don't even know if I'd call it a documentary. But yeah, we'll call it
It's like a weird therapy session.
It really is. It's the band back together to talk shit about the bad thing that happened to us, but we're really all super successful white people that still got our careers, right? But we're still mad about this one fucking thing.
So I wanted to try to dig up the article and read it because I've never read it, and it's only been recently and really only in this documentary that I understood that term was an attack against them and not. Yeah. Because when I was a kid, I didn't understand that it was meant to be derogatory.
No, it was like the coolest thing, right? Like,
I thought it was fun. Like, I'm with Laura Shuler Donner. What? are you kidding me? It's fucking awesome. Like, it's a gift, you know? Like,
it really is. Like, come on. Like, even Rob Lowe. Like, Rob Lowe, it was like a great time. I mean, of course, it's fucking Rob Lowe, right?
Yeah.
Like, cocaine, threesome, I'm going to record everything, bad boy Rob Lowe is like, who are his, like, can we just take a side tangent? The fuck are his PR people?
Yeah, I know, right? Like,
because, like, we remember, like, you and I mean, we remember.
That's a guy who should not, like, in Kent, like, if he had that career at that age right now, he would not be here. Like, no. he would never get to work again. You know, it's it's weird. And you know, not hating on him, like, I think part of it helps that he owns almost all of it. Like, he doesn't shy away from, like, yeah, you know, like, it's just the way things were then, you know. I walked away from this genuinely feeling bad for two people, Emilio Estevez and Andrew McCarthy.
Oh, yes, because I want to see that fucking movie. Don't you? Like, after hearing kind of like the, like, what could have been, right? Like, that and also what seems like. So, okay, can I ask you something? Okay, like, since we're talking about, this is the biggest question I have. Do we know, like, as you as a Brat Pack guy, like, who knows kind of some of the lore, was there a fract? Like, they didn't really, they kind of glossed over the fact that it feels like there was a huge fracture between the two guys. Like,
oh, for sure.
The script happened, like, didn't happen because of the article. It feels like it severed their friendship. Do we know, like, how severing it was? Because,
I mean, he says that he hasn't seen Emilio Estevez since the premiere of St. Elmo's Fire.
That's right. That's right. Which is a glossing over of it, right? Like, and even then, they look very kind of, like, they're very awkward in their interview.
I think Andrew McCarthy is an awkward person. Of the quote Brat Pack, he is the person that I always most identified with.
Okay.
It's specifically in St. Elmo's Fire. You know, it's one of my favorite movies. But, like, I felt like he was always not... He was, like, the kid they the just...
The background.
Yeah. You know? Like, he was, like, not the cool one. Yeah. Not the cool one.
He wasn't.
He wanted to be, but he just wasn't. You know?
No, he wasn't. But it's weird. It's interesting. Like it's interesting to hear you talk. Like, can I ask, just because this is such a conversation that like when I watched it, the thing that I also thought about, I just kept on thinking about Ryan. But also, like, I feel like, and this is something that I wanted to ask, like, Ryan always saw himself as like the Judd Nelson characters, right? Like, he feels like ultimate. It was so weird to watch this and waiting for Nelson to show up and he doesn't. Like, that was like not only the most awkward thing for me, but also the kind of weirdly emotional. I got kind of emotional because like I kept on wanting to see him because like I honestly was kept on thinking about both you and Ryan because it's such a strong, like St. Elmo's Fire is one of those things for you guys. I mean,
it literally ends with Andrew McCarthy answering his phone and going, Judd.
And then the song comes on, right?
Yeah.
Like
the most melancholy fucking version of that song I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah. And it got me like that got me emotional, but it got me this is like a bigger conversation I wanted to have with you about these documentaries. It hit a heartstone in me, but not because of that, but because of Ryan, because of the fact that like, if Ryan was here, he'd be so mad that they didn't get Nelson. Like he would have probably shit on this movie if I'm not correct, because they didn't get Nelson, because he like, it's Judd Nelson. Like even me, like I got a little upset. I'm like, what the fuck? It's Judd Nelson. Also fucking Molly Ringwald, right? Like these two are people that I always associated with the Brat.
Molly Ringwald. So of all of them, like I kind of understood that Molly Ringwald didn't want to talk about it. Like she has been so like reclusive. Like not that she doesn't act. It's just
no.
Like, she shows up at the John Hughes stuff every once in a while because she had such a profound relationship with him. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, you know, she just doesn't do a lot anymore. And she, you know, I kind of get like, I've talked about it. Like, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to relive it. I don't, you know, I get that. Judd Nelson, I don't know. I feel like of all of them, he's still carrying a lot. Like, clearly Andrew McCarthy was too, but like, he's still carrying around a lot of shit from, not from that term, but just from that era.
So
he seems like such an angry dude at the time. And I would guess maybe he still is.
That he hasn't let go of that turmoil and what he thought he was going to be. Because, I mean, like, I think about it and I'm like, that dude, like the weirdest part is that after New Jack City, that dude should have gotten a lot more work. Like, that is a cool, badass role that people should have went, fucking Judd Nelson? Okay, let's fucking hire him to do like this weird supporting actor in action genre movies where we can like have him be the cool fucking character. Like, you know, the fucking dude in the 80s movies and 90s action films. Like he like literally Mario Van Peebles created it was like a stop, right? Like it wasn't even a character. He was like a sidekick to Ice Cube or Ice-T, but if you guys go back and watch New Jack City, watch how cool he is. He's just a fucking badass character that just does nothing. Like he does stuff, but he's not like, he's so just kind of like, I'm going to stand in the background, smoke fucking cigarettes and have my fucking cool ass haircut, my cool fucking clothes. and my fucking cool guns. Like, that's literally the character, right? But there were a bunch of guys in the 80s that did that shit, but they didn't do it as well as fucking Judd Nelson. So I can kind of see, like, him so wanting that second half of his career, the one that Emilio had, the one that Rob Lowe had. Like, even Andrew McCarthy, because Andrew McCarthy went into directing. Like he went to the stage, he went back to the stage. He's like, and then he kind of bounced between, like, you know, stage and theater, like, and directing. So, like, all the dudes except for him that were in the Brat Pack, or even the Brat Pack adjacent, because they mention Cruise, because, like, Cruise was like that dude that everybody hated because he got everything so young, and it just became easy for him. So it would be like, the crassness in me thinks that Nelson is working on his own thing, in his own kind of I call these bio docs, right? Because that's kind of what they are, but they're kind of not. But man, it's a hole. Like, those two make it a giant hole in this thing that I cannot absolutely call it a true documentary about the Brat Pack, even though they kind of define it and Judd is in it, but Molly isn't, which I found weird. But that's the funnest part about the
I mean, he brings up Molly at some point. I think Ali Sheedy maybe asked, have you spoken to Molly? Yeah. And he says, yeah, you know, I asked her about doing it and she, you know, didn't really seem interested or whatever. I appreciate that he got outsiders' perspectives. You know, producers, directors, but I really wanted more. Like, when he talked to John Cryer, I was like, I want more of this. Cause, like, John Cryer was very upfront. Like, he was like, I wanted to be in, like, that part of that. Like, I was outside of that. I wanted to be in this group. And, like, and Andrew McCarthy's insistence, like, you know, probably rightfully so, other than when they were, like, filming, they weren't together. It wasn't like DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire. Like, that whole crowd that was running around, like, they weren't necessarily doing that, you know? Like, they were just working together. And, you know, it kind of made sense. Like, they were very, very talented and like on fire at the time, almost all of them. And so it just made sense that they kept getting cast in these movies. But, like, also when you think about it, so The Breakfast Club is this definitive high school movie.
Yes.
And St. Elmo's Fire, for at least a group of people, is this definitive young adult 80s movie. Mm-hmm. Both of those fucking movies came out in 1985.
Yeah.
They came out the same year.
The same fucking cast are playing high schoolers and are playing people that are college graduates. Because, I mean, that's the whole thing with the St. Elmo's Fire, right? Like, graduating college, going into the world.
Right. They're 24, 25. Yeah. And The Breakfast Club, they're 16, 17.
Yeah. So, like, literally almost a decade. They jump a decade. And, like, you know, but, I mean, the guys were, like, they were at the perfect age, right? They were, like, around anywhere between 20 to, like, 22. Like, all of them. Like, they weren't, like, and that's the thing that's wild to me, is that Andrew McCarthy gets his first role at literally 17. Like, that to me, and his own admission that, like, you know, he smoked too much pot. He didn't listen in college. He didn't want to do anything but act. Like, it gives me a sense of, like, and this is the thing that I, like, it's only, there's a lot of implication here and not outright talking about it. And, like, I think this is the thing that I told you, which is that this is one film that I feel could have been a 6-part miniseries, right? Like, because
for sure. There's so many, like, the whole time I'm like, I know, like, are they gonna talk to James Spader? Because I would like for them to talk to James Spader. Because again, not Brat Pack, but very in that, like, he worked with almost all of them at some point.
John Cusack. Crazy-ass John Cusack. Why isn't he a part of this? Because he was so adjacent to this. Because his, like, you know.
Yeah. I feel like he's somebody who would think he's too good for this. Like,
yeah. No, of course. I think that, like, even though he's making, like, low-budget shit right now, like, he would. He absolutely would. Because it's not made by him or his guys. But, like, or even, like, I know Piven was around this time. Even though we didn't see him, he didn't come into, like, the early 90s into prominence. But, like, all the guys from the John Hughes circle because of all of the Chicago things, right? Like, I wanted that Midwest milieu. I wanted to fucking find out. Like, as soon as they started to show the footage of mullet-wearing zeitgeist of the 80s, John Hughes, I'm like, okay, he is just as big of a part of this because he built you guys.
Yeah.
I want to know about that relationship because I know for a fact that many of you do not like him, like did not like him. There are some people that adored him. And I wanted more of that too because the Brat Pack was, I mean, like you said, Breakfast Club, right? That was part of the Brat Pack. That was the mystique. And then here's another one, a big one, Anthony Michael Hall. Like, because he was around, he was on the outside.
He was like the little, much like John Cryer, he's like a little brother to that. Actually, I think, a teenager when they're making the Breakfast Club.
Yeah, he was. He was the one teenager. He was 15 years old. Like, let that set in, guys. Like, Anthony Michael Hall, like, I feel like we don't give Anthony Michael Hall enough credit. Like, I feel like something happened where he didn't get his Back to the Future to where he became, like, the biggest fucking star in the universe. Because if you watch him in his performances in all of those movies, like, he's the best. He is, like, you see him and you go, yeah, he's like a Robert Downey Jr., like with his like mania, but man, does he land his jokes and his timing. Like Weird Science. That fucking kid after Weird Science should have been a star. Like, but it's also like it's weird because it's like there's all these kids, like there are all these people that are that you want to hear their opinions about this group because they were a part of that, not a part of it, but they were. Like, it was the 80s, and these were a bit, like, the Brat Pack had, like, I don't know if, like, kids, like, nowadays, kids can understand what this group of actors were, like, what they were to us, like, watching them as young, like, younger kids, and seeing them as a group, it was, like, the only thing I can compare it to is the Rat Pack. Right, like, and what our parents or our parents' parents must have thought of the Rat Pack when they saw them together, right? Because it's like, wow, like those are stars. They may not be true.
Yeah, they're fucking cool, man. Like those kids are cool. Like they like you want to be with them, you want to hang out with them, you want to date them. Like you just want to be part of that group, and like. Part of me like understands why certain people maybe don't get included for lack of time, one thing, but also it is very much Andrew McCarthy's like thing. Sure. Like it's him going through all this. That's James Spader's the one, like, I know they've worked together recently. Like, on James Spader's show, The Blacklist. But like everybody else is kind of on the out. Like he and Anthony Michael Hall probably didn't have they knew the same people, but not a ton of crossover there. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So like, I get why maybe some people aren't there because it's just about like his experience. I wanted more of him and Emilio talking. I like the fact that Emilio was like, yeah, like I fucked up. I thought this guy was cool. You know, mm-hmm. I thought he was there to have a good time and that, you know, it was a fluff piece.
Yeah.
It reminded me a lot of Almost Famous, you know?
Yes, it really did.
Like you bring the kid along because the kid will make us look like he's a fan. So,
yeah.
You know, he'll, you know, he won't talk about the bad stuff or whatever. And he does. And, you know, you get a little pissy about it because you thought the journalist was your friend and a fan. I agree with his position of like, hey, like I came along for this. I saw, you know, some stuff. I wrote my piece. I were, you know, honest to a degree that he thinks he's being honest and, you know, come up with this little zeitgeisty term. It catches on. What I really like, I thought Andrew McCarthy was going to punch that dude in the fucking face. I was waiting on it.
Yeah, I was too. It doesn't help that, like, okay, so, like, here's the thing, is that, like, they're both in, like, they're both very fallible, but, like, it's
Andrew McCarthy's kind of owning that, like, hey, I let this get to me and I shouldn't have, and yes. This guy is just like, I mean, I don't care that it affected your life and your opinion, like, you can't be at least a little bit apologetic. Like, shit, man. Like, I'm sorry if you thought that did some kind of harm to your career. Like, I was telling the truth that I saw. And I thought it was a fun little term. Like, that I could just... A label that I could put on the situation, you know? Mm-hmm. And, like, you guys saw it as something that... you know, as this real negative and kind of scattered in the wind. And, like, I'm sorry for that. But he doesn't. He's, like, not at all apologetic. And
oh, no, absolutely not.
And I didn't like that, you know? Like, if you even inadvertently do some harm to somebody, like, how do you not understand that it affect, like, actors are delicate people, man. Like, should they be? Maybe not as much as they are, but, like, labeling somebody like that can, you know, not just affect the way they see themselves, like, that's their own therapy to get through, but, like, it becomes this fucking thing in Hollywood of, like, well, they're kind of brats, we don't really want to work with them. Some people worked through it. Some people didn't, you know, some people transitioned, you know, some people had other things to fall back on. And, like, it just kind of sucks that some people saw it as a negative. I think at the time, if the group, if all of them as a whole had kind of embraced it and been like, yeah, fuck you. I think they had the power at the time to turn what they saw as a negative into a positive because they were the box office.
They definitely were, and they could have, but we both know, like, the thing is that it was too much for a bunch of kids, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the thing to me, is that it was too much, like, and here's the thing is that, like, I will give Andrew credit because he tries to be balanced about this whole thing with the article, but you can tell that he just wants to say, this motherfucker ruined my career and these other people's careers. What the fuck? With a couple of correct words and some pithy, like, you know, this guy Emilio is so up his own ass, it's not even funny.
What, like, 24-year-old isn't up their own ass? Like, exactly. I don't. And I get, like, you don't want, like, insiders reading that. But, like, everybody knows that young stars are kind of just up their own ass. Even people who aren't stars are just up their own ass at that age.
They're 20-somethings. They only give a shit about themselves and what they can do, and what the world isn't giving them. So, like, you know, yeah. But at the same time, it's like, there's, like, this guy is just as much of a fucking little prick as Andrew McCarthy is. Like, you go into that situation and you just go, things were said, I'm sorry, that's all there is to it. And then McCarthy goes, you know what, maybe I overreacted, I'm sorry. And you guys shake your hands. You don't do this weird fucking dance where the ego is still in play. Do you know what I mean? Like
yeah.
I watched that scene and I was like, this is fucking bullshit. This guy ain't going to say anything. And McCarthy isn't going to say anything. Like, McCarthy was very kind of like
going around. Yeah, he was being very diplomatic about it. And yes. I would have appreciated it more if he was just like, look, man, not for nothing, but like you wrote this, it affected all of our lives, largely in a negative way at the time, because we couldn't see past you basically just being like, we're a bunch of punk ass kids who don't know what we're doing and we don't take this seriously. And, you know, some of them weren't taking it as seriously as they should. I mean, probably Rob Lowe for one, who continued, like, he might not say it, but he continued to work because he's an incredibly gorgeous human being. Like, but
that is
like,
literally,
he was definitely in it to party from like at that time. Like, it was definitely like, I get into all the clubs, I get all the girls, like, everybody wants to be with me, hang out with me, or sleep with me, you know. And it's hard to fucking blame him. If you look like Rob Lowe when you were 25, you'd probably been doing the same thing.
Exactly. But also, here's the other thing that's not mentioned about Rob Lowe, is that he did the work. He started, he literally, after Less Than Zero, or after the bullshit that happened with the drugs and the threesome and the video, he had to start from bottom, and he did the work. I mean, you look at his shit in from 89 to like around early 2000s, and it's not a pleasant ride. Like, there's a lot of like supporting roles where he plays a yuppie douchebag, right? Like, yuppie douchebag, not even yuppie douchebag with a name. It's like yuppie douchebag number two, right? Until he gets into this point where he starts doing indie work, he starts doing TV, and in TV, that's where he thrives, right? Because everybody loves, like, you know, at a certain point, they've forgotten about all the bad boy behavior, and he's all of a sudden on TV, and it's like, oh, yeah, you know what? I forgot. I really fucking like Rob Lowe. And he's a, like you said, he's a beautiful fucking human being. I mean, the man is 62 or 63 right now? And yeah, of course, he's had some work, but he still looks like fucking Rob Lowe, right? Like, you look at him and go,
holy work can only take you so far.
So far.
He's 60.
Okay.
He just turned 60.
60 fucking years old, man. Like, that is, that, like, yeah. Wow. Like, he looks, again, but he still did the work. Like, you don't have to fucking, like, and most of these people, if you really look at their careers, they have pretty fucking great careers, right? Like Andrew McCarthy, he can bitch and moan what he wants about, like, you know, that final movie, like, that movie that they were supposed to make. I can't remember what it was called, Young and Upcoming Man or something like that. But at the end of the day, he's had the Tim Hutton career. Right, like, because he goes and meets Tim Hutton, and like,
what that's I love great, man. I fucking love God. Tim Hutton.
Fucking let himself age. He's on a fucking farm, kind of like, you know. I'm gonna go back to theater occasionally. I'm gonna do occasional work. Like, it's great, right? Like, you can tell that he has no problems with talking about his early career, his early rise, and everything is fine for him. And it's like, like, there's a lot of, like, I like the tour. I like the getting the band back together. But, like, underneath it, it does feel a little bit like Andrew McCarthy's therapy session that I mean, shit, he could probably make another one of these and still fill it up with a bunch of stuff that would be interesting. Like, that's why I said, like, I'd much rather have had this a limited series and not a movie, because it feels so bereft at 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Some of these docs are too long. This one is like suffering from not long enough, right? Like, you almost wonder, it's done by ABC News, and I almost wonder if the reason why it's 92 minutes is because it perfectly fills a 2-hour time slot for ABC or whatever news affiliate, so that in a couple of months they can show it in a 2-hour block in the middle of summer, like on a Saturday night or a Friday night or even like a Sunday night, right? Yeah. Like, that's what it feels like at its crassest. But there's a lot to be had about this one. Something that we didn't talk about was, the three big ladies of the show, Ally Sheedy, Demi Moore, and Leah Thompson, like, man, do they navigate that well. Like, you know, all of the questions and all the weirdness that McCarthy puts them through. But also, like the thing that I got from them, each of them, was, man, I really, like, right now, currently, as is, each of them close to 60 or at 60, I really need them to start doing more work, because they're so luminous. They're so kind of utterly charming. Like, I fell in love with Ally Sheedy all over again just watching her for that 10 minutes that she's in the movie. Yeah. Like, and you could tell that even McCarthy lights up with her. Like,
yeah, there's this... he tells her, he's like, I always had a crush on you.
Yeah. I mean, who didn't in Breakfast Club and everything else that she did, right? Like, but it just reminded me, I was like, holy shit. Oh, Demi Moore, like, I mean, yeah, I know she's had a lot of work, but, like, the work is something, but the charm and the aura is just, like it, and same with Leah Thompson, right? Like, you just watch all three of them and you go,
I felt that way about everybody, though. Like,
that's true.
When was the last thing you saw? Like, we see Rob Lowe a lot. I mean, he's a staple on TV now, mm-hmm. which is fine. But, like, I don't know the last time I saw Andrew McCarthy in anything major. I can't tell you the last time I saw Emilio Estevez in anything at all.
Well, Emilio is a director now, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's literally what he does now. Like, he refuses, like, from what I understand, the big selling point for, like, Young Guns 3 is that he wants to direct it, but also, like, that's the thing, is that he wants to direct it at a budget, and what's stopping him is that, like, he's willing to star in it and do all the stuff, which he wasn't before, but it's the budget, right? He wants a bigger budget if he wants to star, because all he does is literally direct, other than, Mighty Ducks.
Yeah, I was going to say, he was in the Mighty Ducks TV show. I didn't watch it, though. So
it's like the first season is very Gordon, and then the second season they kind of did the same thing that they did with D2 and D3, which is they made it about the kids, which is fine. I mean, I'm okay with it. He's looking a lot more like like his dad than ever before. It's kind of weird because he's aging like his dad, like how his dad had this big open face. Same thing. Emilio has literally got that big face now, that catcher's mitt of a face. But yeah, from what I understand, it's like all directing that, and he will only take small roles in his directing things. I think I saw his last one, which is about the New York Public Library shutdown. He's very politically inclined. I appreciate that about his films. But that movie was like, you know, I think I saw it on Netflix or Hulu, literally. And it was just like, oh, Emilio Estevez, and he's directing. Okay, let me just see this. But yeah, you're right. There's like most of them, like, you know, they're working, but they're not working. And, right.
And I mean, I get whatever happened. But here's the thing, looking back on it, the chemistry that these people have together is fucking undeniable. And mm-hmm. the fact that they didn't continue to work together is a shame. And if nothing else, this stupid article took that away from us, because they're just, they're so, like Andrew McCarthy talks about it. He's like, I haven't seen most of these people in decades. And, but what I feel for them when I see them, like, it's just profound. You know, like, I'm just so happy to be around them again. And, yeah, like, I would love to see them all do something together, you know? And not in a, like, stupid cameo-laden, like, an actual serious production of something, you know?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. Like, I know that there's, like, okay, so post this movie and its success, which it's been very successful for Hulu, if you believe Hulu's, like, you know, discussion of it, which is a good thing. But I guess what's been brought up is all of theirs, like, all of the St. Elmo's Fire cast wanting to possibly see about a sequel, like a reunion sequel. Not, like, not a reunion tour, but an actual, like, let's see where these characters are 30 years later. You know, like, you know, with families and not families, and did some people stay together or some people broke up and whatever, which I find interesting, but I feel like the magic of that is Joel Schumacher and Joel not being around anymore. I mean,
so St. Elmo's Fire was written by Schumacher about his college years. Like, it's
exactly.
There's a lot of weird things in the movie, but one thing that specifically, and they show it in the Bratz documentary, is they're all in the urinal or in the restroom, and they dunk, like, Judd Nelson dunks Billy's head in the toilet, like, because he lost his job and, like, just all of this shit, and they kind of, like, reconcile, and then they do this, like, a booga booga booga, ah ah ah. That is 100% something that Joel Schumacher and his friends used to do. Yeah. He had to tell them, like, because they don't, they're like, what the fuck is this, Joel? He's like, this is something me and my buddies in college used to do. Like, it's literally an inside joke for five fucking people. It means nothing to anybody else. And so, like, that's that movie for me. You know, mm-hmm. that it's Joel Schumacher's, like, early life. And, like, you say whatever you want about the man, but, like, I don't know how you make a sequel to this without him.
Exactly. No, you can't.
I would, like, rather see them talk about the movie.
Yeah. I'd rather have them do a, like, let's go ahead and talk about, let's go ahead and do a 2-hour documentary on the making of St. Elmo's Fire, and be an ode to Joel Schumacher, because, you know, like, I feel like he's in need of reassessment by people, because I don't think that youngins understand what Schumacher, regardless of the Batman movies, like, if you take those out of the equation or you include them in, how much his style was a part of defining the 80s, like, in so many fucking ways. And even in the 90s, and how powerful he was a filmmaker, what he meant.
St. Elmo's Fire. Look, DC Cabs is first. Well, yep. The Incredible Shrinking Woman is his first movie. But that's it's a pretty low-budget affair. That Lily Tomlin, Charles Grodin, like, kind of goofy. But he does that, and he does DC Cab. Moderate, you know, whatever. St. Elmo's Fire in 1985. The Lost Boys. Cousins is not a movie that gets talked about much, but, like, it definitely has a cast, you know, Ted Danson, yes. Isabella Rossellini, Sean Young, William Peterson, Lloyd Bridges. I mean, it's pretty big. But I think it's like based on like a French thing.
It is.
But
cousin cuisine. Okay. About an affair between two cousins. Very French.
Flatliners. Dying Young. Oh, man. Young, Flatliners.
Yep.
Falling down. And The Client. Like,
and A Time to Kill.
Think yeah. Well, A Time to Kill is after Batman after Forever. But Batman Forever was a hit.
Yeah.
Like, we knock it now, but, like, there's a reason Batman and Robin exist, and that's because Batman Forever was fucking huge.
It was. It was, like, we kind of loved it. Like, I mean, you know, like, we were, what, 14, 15 when it came out? Like, we made it a hit. Like, it wasn't like it didn't do money. I mean, we wanted to see Jim Carrey. We wanted to see fucking Tommy Lee Jones. Like it's a joke now, but it wasn't a joke then. And like, you know, my ever hope is that Warner Brothers will get their cranium rectal situation sorted out, and we will be able to see the Schumacher. What is it? Schumacher
cut.
Yeah, the Schumacher cut or the Schumacher assembly, whatever you want to fucking call it. But that three hour thing that many people have already seen and love to tease us all about. But yeah, like even his post Batman career managed to be an interesting thing until the very end, right? I mean, he was still doing big budget films. I mean, he did Phantom of the Opera, like regardless of what people think.
His post Batman and Robin stuff, 8mm is uneven. Flawless is very interesting.
Yes.
Tigerland, Bad Company, Phone Booth, I would argue, is an underrated like thriller of a movie.
Yes.
Veronica Guerin, Phantom of the Opera, Number 23, and then Trespass.
I know Trespass and like the 12, but I will tell you, Blood Creek, man, that's a nasty bit of like of horror films, like of a horror film, like, and it has a great cast. It has
Shea Whigham, Henry Cavill, Dominic Purcell, Michael Fassbender. Yeah,
playing a fucking Nazi, playing a vampire Nazi. Like, how do you like? Okay. This is a movie that was made very low budget. Like, I will fucking definitely say people need to see Blood Creek, because it's like a nastier version of Lost Boys. It was like he was tired of the sexiness and he goes, you know what, hold my beer. I'm gonna make a nightmare for you, and I'm gonna go into the deep recesses of my mind being a gay Jewish man, and I'm gonna come up with the worst possible scenario you could ever come up with. Which is Nazi vampires. Like, it's great. Like, it truly is like The Last Stand, because Trespass and 12 were terrible. I'm sorry, but they are. Like, I've seen them. I mean, I saw
Trespass. I vaguely remember it.
Yeah, it was during the home invasion thing, and you've got a great cast that is just non-existent. Like, Nicolas Cage and Nicole Kidman are so utterly wasted. Ben Mendelsohn.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as soon as you have Cam Gigandet in your movie, you know you're in trouble. Like, you know, but yeah, I mean, I honestly don't think that people understand what, like, the Schumacherness of it all, and especially with St. Elmo's Fire. Like, I still remember, like, people flipping out for this guy's movies. Like, that's why he got the movies he got. And like, he showed that he could, like, the weird, crazy part is that he showed, like, a range that few people can do. Like, so what you're telling me is that you could do St. Elmo's Fire on one end of the spectrum, but you can also do The Lost Boys at the other end. Like, that's a big difference, right? Yeah,
he wanted to be a director the way the old directors were. Like, not Michael for... Cooper. Yeah, a lot of directors these days are auteurs, like even Scorsese, like to a degree, he's made some like, oh, that doesn't feel necessarily like a Scorsese movie, but like, mm-hmm. it's mostly just the same shit.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah.
it plays on themes over and over and over again. And yeah. you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you're into, but
like Howard Hawks could make a Western, and Howard Hawks could make
a musical,
a musical and a romantic comedy. And yep. like, in, I think Schumacher tried to somewhat always spread his, like, do something a little different, you know?
Yep. No, absolutely. Absolutely. I just feel like it's shit that he got shit upon for things that were, like, out of his control. I mean, you listen to those commentary tracks and the amount of oversight that he had, nobody could navigate that. No one could navigate that. And then also, to his own admission, he said, like, you know, like, it's weird to listen to how he, like, if you listen to the Batman and Robin commentary track that he has on any of the discs, starting with the Blu-ray, it's really interesting to hear how he's like, these are my partners. Like, people don't recognize that. They just think that this guy got like $100 million back when $100 million meant something. And he just did whatever the fuck he wanted. No, yeah,
Warner Brothers is making $100 million Batman movie. They were especially I know this has turned into a Joel Schumacher thing, especially coming off of Batman Returns and the absolute, like, nightmare it was for them marketing wise, the McDonald's fiasco, like how unhappy McDonald's was with having to fucking give these Batman toys to kids for a movie that they definitely should not be seeing. So they wanted to, like, change the narrative. They wanted it to be way more kid friendly. And Schumacher gets the blame for that. And, like, maybe he could have stood up for, like, been like, hey, guys, this is really dumb. But, like, eventually they would have just been like, well, you can go home. We'll find somebody to make the movie we want to make.
Exactly. No, and that's why everything happened the way that it did, was that it was a partnership. And, like, the weirdest part is that I'm glad he never apologized. Because you never should apologize for making a movie, but he absolutely gave you the explanation. Like, these were my partners. This is what they wanted. There's not much more I can do about this. I'm, you know, and you could tell behind it, it was like, I didn't know what I was getting into. Like, I kind of knew, but I didn't. And, you know, the second time they did it, because it was a success, they leaned heavier into it, and he got a big fucking payday. Like, he got a massive payday for Batman and Robin. Like amounts, like I think it was like $15 million plus a cut of the gross, first dollar gross. So you think about that, and yeah, of course you're going to do what you're going to try to work within the confines, right? I always find it funny when people start digging at Schumacher for Batman and Robin, or even Batman Forever. And I'm like, yeah, but you're one to talk. What have you done? Have you gone to the excess of, like, the Schumacher was at the tippy top at that era, at the tippy top of big budget filmmaking. Right? Yeah. Like, there was, like, at the time, there was him, Spielberg, Tony Scott. Not even Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott had still not ascended to, like, that didn't happen until Gladiator, right? Like,
well, Ridley Scott was kind of in director jail for a while because of how much money, as much as people, like, will point to Blade Runner now, that movie lost a lot of money.
Yep. Well, it wasn't, and then it wasn't only until the critical reassessment of that movie and a bunch of his other movies that people started to go, oh, you know what, maybe we should give a chance to him. And, like, to be perfectly honest, if Gladiator didn't come around, he doesn't have the second half of his career. Like, let's be honest. Like, Gladiator, he made, like, I mean, that's a thing. But Cameron was, like, these were the big budget guys at the time, right? And Schumacher was a part of that because he was making Batman movies. He was the only dude making superhero movies. Let that sink in, guys. The only dude in town that was making superhero movies. There was no other game in town. Like, he was the thing, right? Like, they tried to make Batman movies. I mean, nobody wanted to touch X. Like, X-Men was still at least another, like, 7 years away, right? Like, I don't understand why people don't look with a little bit more respect, because, yeah, he fucked up. It was a fucked up movie, but it wasn't all his fault. There were a lot of people there that was to blame, that were to blame. He was, like, the fact that Batman and Robin is an actual movie, I'm sorry, I get quotes around it, it's an actual movie, is literally a minor miracle. Like, that it actually has a story and a plot.
Yeah, that it functions at all as anything. Like, Batman Forever, you can, there's a lot to hold on to there. Like, as goofy as it is, there's a lot to hold on to there. But yeah, Batman and Robin, that it functions in the slightest. It probably is only because of Joel Schumacher.
Yeah. Like, literally is because of that. Because, like, everybody else is just like, woohoo, let's do our thing. Like, you watch that movie and everybody is in a different fucking movie. Like, literally in a different movie. You know, like, I want to see the movie that Arnold is in that whole thing. I want to see Arnold's movie, his movie, and Batgirl's movie. Like, that's it. Those are the only two I care about. Like, the one that George Clooney is in, which I still find is so wild. Like, to say that George Clooney was Batman at a certain point, I mean, and he came back to being Batman at a certain point too, is wild. Like that's just fucking wild to me. That's the 90s, right? In a capsule. George Clooney, star of ER, star of From Dusk Till Dawn, Batman. But it's like Alfred dying. I mean, but it's all there. It's a movie. Like you said, like, I mean, it's held together with string and gum, but it's there. So yeah, like, you know, it's all to say that I have a lot of reverence for Joel Schumacher and a lot of respect for him, because, and to say that somebody should make a sequel to a movie that was so deeply personal, but, like, oddly very commercial, I don't think so. Like, I think we should leave it as is, and do something different. Or you could get together and just do something. Like, what's to say, like, you know, Andrew McCarthy, director, like, you can get these guys together to do something. I'm fairly certain they all have love and affection for you. Like, it's very apparent. Like, even, like, the thing that I found interesting was, like, yeah, they were kind of awkward, Emilio and him.
Well, but Emilio says, he's like, I turned down, like, anytime anybody wants me to do any of these retrospectives, I just say no. And he's like, well, why are you talking to me? And he's like, because it's you. Because you called me and you asked.
And that's all you need to hear. Like, it's almost like 30 years of bullshit or 40 years of bullshit, like, just gets melted away in that moment. And you want them to be, like, that's the thing, is that at the end of the day, I know it works because I literally want them to be friends again. Like, I literally saw that moment and I'm like, please be friends again. Guys, you guys were so good together. You guys were, like, you could tell that they were friends when you watched them on screen. And it's just like, you just want them to have that kind of part of the happy end, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting doc. It's very much, like I said, it's like this recent outcrop of biodocs where it's like, the subjects are in control, so there's not a lot of criticism or critique.
Yeah.
And it's very cleanly, but at the same time, it's kind of like, it's a nostalgia bomb, right? Like, as soon as I heard the David Foster St. Elmo's Fire theme, I was like, and that took me back. Man, that took me back. And then I had to listen to it like five or six more times on my phone. Like, you know, while I was doing some work and stuff, or just the soundtrack in general, which Can I just say, I really want a fucking vinyl of the David Foster score. And
I have the soundtrack on vinyl, so.
Oh, that's right. I remember you picked it up for like $2, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was pretty cheap. So, yeah, it's a really good soundtrack. Even just for the, like, the instrumental pieces and the Man in Motion, like, it's such a good fucking song.
It really is. And that video, them including the video.
The video is ridiculous.
Yes, it is.
All right, so before we get to a little more talk about Bad Boys, since we've both seen it now, real quickly, House of the Dragon is back. You're not going to watch it. You texted me something like people are comparing it to The Red Wedding. That's baffling to me. Like, one person dies in the episode, the premiere, and it's of the level of The Red Wedding. I mean, you don't care about spoilers. You're not going to watch the show anyway. So at the end of last season, one of the kids dies. The Rhaenyra, who's it's hard to explain if you don't watch the show. But anyway, these two warring factions of the family.
Okay, so I've only not seen two episodes of the final season, or the first season.
Oh, okay.
So you can actually, I mean, and if you want to say it, like, it's not going to offend me.
One of her kids dies.
Okay.
It feels a little accidental, but, like, so Damon is like, hey, an eye for an eye, and he sends these people behind enemy lines to kill one of their sons as well. The Greens, I guess we'll do Greens and Blacks. One of the Green sons as well. And, like, the two guys are just like, I mean, the kid's a kid, right? He said kill the son. So they just kill one of Allison's babies.
Oh, whoa. That's hardcore.
Yeah. It's pretty fucked up. So.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's a little rough, but, like, it's not, I don't think it's on the par with The Red Wedding. It's a really good episode, and it's a good, it was a good premiere. I don't know that, like, I don't know. This show doesn't have the momentum that Game of Thrones had. It really just doesn't.
It's also the construction of it. They keep on jumping. Do they, like, it
they
sounds
stop,
like
a, they stop jumping, Tom. Like, this literally picks up moments after the season finale.
Okay.
They're done from what they've said. They're done with the time jumping. So, that, which was very jarring in season one.
Yeah,
like every episode, sometimes twice or three times an episode, they would just jump months, years ahead, and it's just like, I don't know who these people are. Unfortunately, it's been 2 years since the end of, almost 2 years since the end of season one, and other than, like, the big characters, I very much was like, I don't remember who the fuck this person is. So, especially the kids, I was just like, I don't remember whose kids who. It doesn't have the momentum that Game of Thrones had, in my opinion. But it's still a fun little watch for the most part. And we'll talk more about The Boys when you catch up. But yeah. I do want to talk about, like, not what happens in the show, but what is currently very briefly happening around the show right now, which I'm finding absolutely hysterical.
Well, I am too. Like, okay, can we merge this with a little bit of Star Wars talk? Because I wanted to talk. Like, I want to talk.
Because the same thing's happening to the Acolyte, except like the people in charge of Star Wars and Disney will react negatively to this, like, review bomb bullshit of the Acolyte. and it will cost us in the future. Whereas Eric Kripke, like, I don't know that Amazon gives a shit as long as people are watching it.
Yep.
Like, they, like, as much, I have a lot of problems with, but we won't get into that. Like, I love that Vought is Amazon, and, like, like, they're just taking shots at the people that give them money to make the show. It's really funny, but, like, Amazon doesn't care as long as everybody's watching, and Eric Kripke just doubles down every chance he gets to be like, this was always a quote woke show. We were always making fun of you.
You, yeah. Which, like, that, like, I think, okay, so, like, our first couple of conversations about The Boys, because we've the funniest part about our show, and I keep on forgetting about it, is that we've been on long enough to where we've had a couple of seasons of The Boys released, and we've talked about it. And our primary conversation has always been, how the fuck is Eric Kripke getting away with basically lambasting certain sectors, the most toxic sectors of fandom? And I found out it's because he never, like, people are stupid. And they've never had the level of, like, I don't know, like, I don't know what happened between this season and last season, but I can tell you this much is that last season, like, it's very apparent. If you don't understand that he's making fun of you and your stupid bullshit, like, you're not you, but, like, you know, the toxic fandom.
I mean, he kind of is, but, like, I'm not so fucking, like, caught up in my own shit that I can't just look at it and be like, oh yeah, that's funny. Like, yeah, or, well, I mean, oh, okay, yeah, that's right. That is, right? A little fucked up about, you know, superhero fanboys, or, like,
yeah,
like, I'm self-aware enough to be like, yeah, that's right. and yeah, not get offended by it.
It's a show. Like, and that tells you, like the funniest part about that is that that tells you how brittle fandom is with their egos about things, which I don't get. Like, when did we become these little, like, when did fandom become a bunch of little Nancy boys? Like, yeah, like, within their feelings.
And it bums me out so much because it's like, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, this is the kind of sort of the end point to what Alan Moore started with,
yeah,
Watchmen, and mm-hmm, Frank Miller started with The Dark Knight. Frank Miller is the person that, like, bought into the bullshit and kind of became, like, the fascist who's anti-fascist, whereas Alan Moore is like, nobody understood what I was saying, so fuck off. And, like, yeah, this is kind of like those two things melded together to their, like, end point, you know? Like,
yeah.
And the show is doing a really, really good job of, like, managing all of it, I think. But it's really funny to watch people be like, oh, wait, so, like, he's not gonna have this, like, super heroic, like, altruistic turn. Like, Homelander is actually the fucking bad guy.
Yeah, he's the piece of shit. Like, what made you think that he wasn't? Like, that's the weirdest part about this all, is, like, reading about the ballyhoo of it all and people, like, being like, what, this is wrong. This is, like, I'm sticking with the comics. And I'm like, wait.
But that's in the comics.
Yeah. Well, and that's what makes me laugh. It's like, okay, so, like, what are you expecting out of this? Like, really, honestly, I'm baffled by people thinking that there was going to be some sort of turn, right? Like he was going to turn out to be okay. Why would you think that? In this show that has that like, here's the thing. This is a show that has a joke that's actually a plot point and a very salient plot point in it, where a microscopic person enlarges himself. And I don't want to ruin it because, like, we know that there's some people that haven't watched The Boys, so they don't understand.
They did the Ant-Man and Thanos's butthole thing, but for real.
Yeah. But for real. Like, what did you think this fucking show was about, you idiots? Like, I'm calling them idiots. They are idiots. Like, anybody who thinks that, like, oh, you turned in a woke show, crybaby, man. It's like.
So you haven't watched it, but there is a character in this season who literally is like that, like Fox News, like stirring up bullshit, like, but she's also a superhero. So that made it extremely obvious. Like, if you weren't getting it before, you're going to get it now.
So he's doubling down, like it was almost like cryptic.
100%. It was like, oh, you still don't get it? Here. I mean, this is stuff that's more or less in the books, but like, it's just, it is the show doubling down on itself. But like, at the same time, there's shit going on with Huey and the rest of the group that it's like, nobody is escaping this being altruistic. Absolutely nobody. They're all flawed. And it, like, it's a weird kind of metaphor for current politics. Of it's like, I mean, everybody's fucked up. I guess it's just which version of fucked up are you going to choose to side with right now?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And like, I don't know that we're better off with one side, with the other side, that, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm trying to talk about it without giving anything away, because, like, I absolutely think you should go in unspoiled, just because it's been, I mean, 4 episodes in 2 weeks is a lot, but it's been a really fun ride. So, and some really fucked up stuff has happened. So, but you mentioned The Acolyte, though, and that the opposite's happening there, where it's getting review bombed, and it's because, and nobody's really standing up for the show. Like, even its creators are just, which I think maybe they're hamstrung by who they work for. You know, like, hey, don't address it. And I hate that, because, like, are you current on it?
Yeah. I'm okay.
I'm enjoying it. I really like it.
I find that people's complaints are misplaced, because, like, here's the thing, is that up until this, like, okay, so first, let's just address, like, the fact that, like, literally the people that are review bombing it are like, you know, we only, like, you know, the only Jedis we accept are white men as Jedis. Like, that's just all there is to it. And they're
stupid, because there's a lot of non-white men Jedis in the prequels.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But these are also the people that don't even like the prequels. Like, they accept the prequels.
That's fair.
They don't love them, right? Like, but here's the thing, is that this is where I'm like, why are you guys all so up in arms? If you watch the fucking Clone Wars, this is absolutely an extension of the Clone Wars and Rebels, where we are getting into Force users. And that's what I find so fascinating, is that why is everybody assuming that this Dark Force user is a Sith? Right? Like, why? Why are we saying that they're a Sith?
Because they have a red lightsaber.
Yeah, because they have a red lightsaber and they wear masks, right?
I think the Ki-Adi Mundi thing is really funny, because like, they're up in arms about, one, how was he alive? Because it's 100 yeah. years. Well, we don't fucking know how long. Yoda lives for like 600 years. Like, Wookiees live for a few hundred years. Like, there's no... Like, actually, if you want a complaint about the show, like, much in the way of the Hobbit films, motherfuckers, you told me there was going to be a Wookiee Jedi.
Yeah.
And I got to see him for, like, 2 minutes. That's bullshit. Like, there's my complaint about the show. I'm pissed because you promised me a Wookiee Jedi, and I didn't really get to see a Wookiee Jedi. Like, you promised me a fucking dragon, Peter Jackson, and I barely got to see a dragon, and I'm still fucking mad about it.
Fucking A, dude. Like,
but, like, that's not a complaint about, like, the story or what's going on. Like, I have no issues with any of that. Like, it got so petty that these motherfuckers were bitching about a fat Jedi from, like, 2 episodes ago. Like, how are you going to have a big, fat, overweight Jedi? And I'm like, because your weight has nothing to do with being a Jedi.
Or your size? Your size. Judge me by your... Like, these acolytes of the preview, the original series, like, to quote your fucking Bible, like, judge me by my son.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, so that's only applied, like, and, like, here's the thing. Like,
so,
and
it only applies with height, not with weight.
Yeah. Well, my favorite part is that these fucking pieces of shit are probably even bigger than the dude that was... That was appearing on screen, and they have the fucking audacity to judge, right? Like, here's the other thing, is that, like, they're trying to include everybody in every way that they can, so that Star Wars is for everybody, right? Like, and it just churns. It's like people can't have nice things, like they just can't. And anything that stretches out the universe, it's remarkable to me that these fucking people are seriously mad about anything that's going on in this show. Like, why are you, like, it's funny. Like, it has to be funny. It's funny to me just because.
I mean, we literally got a show set 100 years before all of known Star Wars.
Yes.
And you're still bitching about how it, quote, breaks canon. And, like, but it doesn't. Like, there's no canon here. Like, I guess there is now with the, like, High Republic stuff, but
that,
like,
takes place, but you know that yeah. takes place 500 years before, and they still had fucking Sith there, and they still are finding out. So these motherfuckers talking about, oh, you know,
and Ki-Adi-Mundi is specifically the person in Phantom Menace who says, but the Sith haven't been seen. I don't think he says a millennia, but he says something in the vein of a long time. And I get people don't want to look at it this way because they only want to see the Jedi as perfect. But even George Lucas was like, these are not perfect people. Like, they lie. They've been the truth to their own. Like, Lucas himself, like, I know they're calling it copifying the Jedi, but he made them soldiers and generals in a war they should have never been involved in. Like, it's a whole thematic thing about how, you know, you can be corrupted. And it's like this show, more than maybe anything outside of the animated stuff since Disney took over, falls in line with that thinking, with what George was doing with the prequels and the Clone Wars, and, you know, trying to better illustrate, you know, that, like, they wanted to be good, but, like, they were corruptible too. You know, there's a reason they fail, you know?
Yep.
So,
and it's this stuff. it's this kind of arrogance. Like I love that about this show, is that it shows all of these Jedi as super arrogant, super pompous. Like, yeah. Like their way is the way, right? Like, I mean, again, like, it's very interesting because he's the show is very taking a Catholic Church approach to,
yeah,
like, to what the Jedi are. And, like, I find it fucking fascinating. Like, I find the fact that they're using this whole Christendom, Muslimdom versus each other for light and dark and what people can be as opposed to what people can't be. I find it very, like, I find it thrilling. Like, I love the fact that in the episode before, like, it's not okay for other people that are Force users to have children that are Force sensitive.
Yeah, like, that's fucked up.
Do you
up,
know how
man.
Fucking, yeah, do you know how fucked up that is?
It's always been messed up that they just go in and like, so. So we currently live in a world and I'm not, I don't want to sound, I honestly don't think about it because I don't have kids and I don't know mm-hmm. how I would feel about it if my kids were going through something like this. I don't mm-hmm. know how I would react. I don't know what I would say, but we live in a world where the people who are very much pissed off about what they're doing with Star Wars and the Jedi will tell you that kids cannot decide what their gender is.
Yep.
They don't know because they're children. And there's, you know, maybe some valid points in there, underdeveloped brains, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But these are also the same people who seem to be okay with the fact that the Jedi show up, give kids a test and be like, hey, do you want to come be a Jedi? Fucking kid cannot make that decision.
mm-hmm.
Like, you're gonna, like, putting Anakin in the to make the decision that he makes is extremely messed up.
Yep.
Like, he's 8. You should have fought to free his mom.
Exactly. Not fucking, like, that's the, okay, so, that's where people get so upset, because they put so much on this, and then when they're told something that is obvious, like, that's the obvious thing, is that Qui-Gon is a piece of shit, because he takes a slave boy away from his mother, and his mother is absolutely should have been free because she was a fucking slave. But you saw worth in that.
It's hard to say with Qui-Gon because he dies. So, like, maybe that turns out differently if Qui-Gon gets to train Anakin. Like, maybe something different happens. But Obi-Wan definitely just didn't give a shit. Like,
Obi-Wan, you know, who says no attachments, kills a motherfucker because he fell in love, but this motherfucker was making fucking time with a princess. Let's not us forget that Obi-Wan Kenobi was let's be honest, he was dipping his stick. That relationship wasn't just a
I agree
unrequited. You know, it's like, I love the fact that they're showing the warts, even though we've been shown the warts already.
Yeah.
Like, it's just making it obvious. And, like, to me, like, the, what I'm affectionately called the Kanaga episode, because he directed the Sith Witch, or the Force Witches episode, is, like, the most damning episode, piece of Star Wars filmmaking I've seen in a long time.
So the story we'd heard up to that point is that the sister burned down killed everybody. And mm-hmm. I can see how from like her, the twin was young mm-hmm. and that's what she saw. And that's kind of like what she was led to assume. But like when we see it, it's clear that girl did not do all that.
No, it's clear that there was something at play, and we don't know what was at play, and we don't know who was at play. But it's very much so. It's a very different. And like, here's the thing. I love the fact that Star Wars takes the fact that she was a child and she was told something and she was led to believe something that was probably not true, because that was their memory of it. Because when we see it come out, it's literally the only person that is there is Sol. And what Sol sees is literally a little girl falling to her fucking death. Doesn't see anything else. So who's the person that imbues that she burnt it all down? The child? Like the girl, the little girl? So you manipulate it? Like, it is so funny to me to watch this show, because the random thoughts I've had about Jedis are literally crystallized in this show. Because it's not damning them, but it's giving them the
it's making them very, very flawed. Like, yes. And, you know, that's good, you know?
Yeah. Well, and then it also, how much do you want to bet that this show is like Dave working with Leslie Hyland in a way to go, let's give context to the point of the fall of the Jedi? Because this feels literally like it's the beginning of the beginning. It's the prologue to what ends up happening with the Phantom Menace. Because like everything is there. Now I understand why like the Sith were able to conduct themselves in the way that they were, because the Jedi don't want that shit. So they're going to keep it undercover. So if all of these Jedi die, it's going to be for nothing. Right? Like, I mean, they're going to cover it up. It's an arresting show. Like, I really do like what they're doing. Even though sometimes I feel kind of... Do you ever feel like the Hitch, like, it's awkward? Like, the Sith Witch stuff was really awkward to me at certain points. But I feel like it was just my uncomfortableness with something new in Star Wars. Because after a moment, I was like, oh, okay, I can do this.
Yeah, so I don't know why that stuff works better for me in animation. But it does. Yeah. Like, because I didn't love it in the Ahsoka show either. Like, in what little we've seen of it in live action, it just hasn't really worked for me. But it's not because of the concept. I just, the way it's done doesn't work for me. In animation, I have not had a problem with it at all. I don't know why it just is a little weird in the live action realm, but you know.
Okay.
It's whatever.
That makes me feel a little bit better about my initial thoughts about them whenever I see new shit going on.
But yeah.
I will say this. Like my favorite part of all of it is the complaint about the cliffhanger. Like, really? You're going to complain about the very thing that Star Wars was built off of?
Series.
Like, that moment where you just see it's been a long time since I got super hyped for something in Star Wars, but that moment where he lifts the lightsaber and it literally wipe cuts to the credit sequence. Dude, like
I'm with you. I thought I was like, I can't wait till next week.
Exactly. Fuck you guys. Like literally, that's what I said. I was like, you know what? Fuck you guys. But that's the serial nature. Like that's the literal humble origins of Star Wars, right? Like literally, like and. Are you there?
Yeah, I lost you for a second. So
yeah.
Sorry about that. No, you're good. I'm with you. I'm really enjoying the show. I can't wait to see where it goes. I hope that Disney and Lucasfilm does not see like more of the negative reactions and just be like, okay, well, this isn't it either. And so, like, I want to see more in this world, you know?
Yeah.
Like, this is the first time I've been hyped up for, like, non, like, Empire era and post-Empire, pre-Empire era of Star Wars, you know? Like, none of the other stuff has really done it for me. So, yeah, I want to see more.
And one last question I have to ask. Is it too obvious that Manny Jacinto's character, Quimmer, is actually not the smuggler, but is actually the dark force user?
I mean, if that turns out to be true, then it was way too obvious.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's not true, then what the fuck was the point of his character? You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
I don't know. I'm not hating his character. I'm just not understanding why he's there unless it is him. But if it is him, what the fuck does he have to do with anything? Like, you know. Yeah, I don't know.
It's kind of like this great thing where it becomes a conundrum, right? Like, it leads to more questions. Like, why did he pose himself like that? Is that just the way that he works and operates as a force user, a dark force user? What is his game in regards to the Jedi and wanting to do this? Like, it's all kind of, it's like, I know, pun totally intended. It's all Russian nesting dolls,
yeah. Right?
Like, it's very much so, like, Leslie Hyland up to her shit. Like, you know, and it's just like, it's a rushing nesting doll, which I don't mind, but I need to see the next episode to kind of truly understand if that's the case, because if that's the case, then it's gotten very interesting, because I don't mind secrets. I don't mind you giving me the rushing nesting doll, the question within a question, right? Like the question is answered, but it leads to more larger questions or smaller questions. I don't mind that.
Yeah.
But I do hope that, like, my ultimate worry is the same as yours, which is that I'll only get one season of this.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, like, the Lucasfilm Disney of it all, they don't understand that you don't listen to fandom. You just don't. I mean, if George had listened to fandom, those prequels, man, there would be something else. And I'm going to be the first one to say and defend the prequels and say, I absolutely need the prequels to be what they are, because they're the last piece of George's vision that we have. Because everything else after that, it's not solely George. And that's kind of sad, right? Like, even Clone Wars is George and Dave together and him handing the baton off, right? But then after that, it's all stuff that George was never involved in. I mean, we've talked about it before. The sequel trilogy is not George's idea. It's not even close to George's idea. Like, you guys, all you have to do is read Michael Arndt's outline Star Wars sequels, and you'll find the PDF of his actual story, his actual thing that he developed with Lucas for months and months, maybe even years, and they just rejected it, which is so much. Like, we have to be honest, it was so much better than what JJ came up with. But oh my god,
yeah.
JJ.
I feel like anything would have been better. Nothing probably would have been better than what we got. So
yeah.
all right. So a few minutes on Bad Boys: Ride or Die. I did finally get to see it. I really enjoyed it. But I couldn't get into it the way I could previously. And I honestly think it's because it was hard for me to see it as anything other than the first leg of the Will Smith apology tour.
Okay. I had harder reasons for getting into it, like fully invested in it. Like, mind you, this is all to say, it's a fun, entertaining
movie. Absolutely.
Like, there's some shit that happens in this movie that's like fucking great. Like, I really, I love that they lean into the Florida of it all. Yeah. In a way that they've not done before.
Yeah, it is the first time it's felt like the movie was actually set in Florida. Like,
yeah,
the Miami we've seen has been like, you know, Club Miami.
Yeah,
it's not actual like Florida swamps, you know.
Yeah, like this one really felt like blurred. Like the one that I've read from Elmore Leonard or George Pelicanos, like the Florida writers, right? Like even Dave Barry to a certain extent. Like it really felt like the Florida that I've read and I've grown up like knowing is Florida. Not this weird Michael Bay, like Miami Vice on steroids and speed.
Yeah.
Which it very much so was. Like, and I appreciated that. The thing that I didn't appreciate, like, okay, so like I was thrown off the whole movie and I need to see it again. Is the first 10 minutes of this movie feel like they were written by an AI GPT chat.
Yeah. Because I'm with you there.
Fuck, man. Like, I literally was like, I looked at my wife and I said, yeah, I fucking think I'm going to leave. I think we're going to leave. I think we're going to go to something else. Because when he went to fucking heaven.
Yeah, it was weird. Like, I didn't understand why they did any of that.
Oh, my God. And then to make it a spiritual movie because everything that happens in the dream happens in real fucking life. So Bad Boys Ride or Die has now added into the fold of all things that there is proof of the afterlife, because everything that Marcus gets from the afterlife is clues to real life.
Right. And
the actual fuck? Like, yeah. Guys, like, I don't know if people are justifiably talking about this first 10 minutes, which is crazier than anything that's been in a bad
movie. I mean, I don't know. They introduced witches in the last movie, so.
Oh, that's fucking true. That is true. Okay, so, like, there's a, like, are they all, like, aiming towards the Bad Boys, like, Ghostbusters crossover?
I don't know. It's such a strange thing. So that's the first 10 minutes. By the 20 minute mark, I'd kind of just forgotten about all of that.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Where it's just like, yeah. Oh, okay, that was a weird thing that happened at the beginning of the movie, but whatever, we're moving on. We've got this plot. Like, also, the minute Ian Griffith shows up, like, you know, he's the bad guy. Like, oh, there's no way to I don't know if it's because like you have two characters that could easily have just been one character, so of course one of them's the bad guy, or there's a lot of like weird shortcuts in the movie. There's no huge surprises, but it is fun. I think the person that surprised me the most was Eric Dane. Like, I think he's doing a really good job at like this bad guy scenery chewing thing.
I mean, he definitely was the Florida of it all. Again, like, he was very much a Florida dude. Like, yeah. You just told, like, it was just a vibe. He had like these fucking, he was just douchebag supreme. Very different from like, this is the West Coast, or this is the East Coast version of his West Coast character in Euphoria, because he is a piece of shit, a ripe, rank piece of shit in Euphoria. But yeah, like, it's weird. Like, they really, okay, so I'm here for a lot of it. What I'm not here for, which I feel is just started to begin, and it's going to get bigger, because this movie has made a decent coin, like, and it's continuing, which, like, the weekend before, it made a huge sum, like, because it did counter programming the way that counter programming is supposed to work with something like Inside Out 2, which is not pour over, but people just going, I don't want to see Inside 2 out 2. Oh, you know what? It's out, that Bad Boys movie. And it's still continuing to make a chunk of money, right? It's probably going to continue on this weekend because nothing is really big, big out there other than Inside Out 2. But what I am not here for is the Fast and Furious-izing of the Bad Boys series, because it feels like it's just begun. Like, yeah. This is like the Fast and Furious 4 movie to this franchise. Like, we're going to get 8 more of these Bad Boys with Will Smith and Martin Lawrence well into their 60s doing this shit with a new cast. Because, like, it just feels like they're going with this whole telenovela. I'm going to introduce new characters that are going to keep on coming back. I'm thinking of DJ Khaled. Tiffany Haddish had a like a role, but then also Vanessa Hudgens and Alexander Ludwig both having bigger roles this time. And then, you know, it just feels like they're wanting to make their own Fast and Furious, right? I'm not mad at it, but then again, it's like, so, like, where are we going with this? What are we doing? Like, I mean, I like Adil and Bilal as directors. I really, like, this now more than ever makes me want to see their Batman movie because, like, people were saying, like, oh, well, it was only $80 million. Well, this was only $95 million. And yeah. It was a, like, that last action scene was more fun than I had more fun in that action scene, that last action scene, than I had in a Bad Boys movie since Bad Boys 2. So, and even then, Bad Boys 2 is kind of like, nowadays I look at it and I go, oh man, there's so many fucking, there's so many troubling things in that movie. Least of all, which is not the abuse of a teenager, which I guess we should kind of, which is probably the best part of this movie. For me, at least, you know, the whole Reggie of it all, which I was not expecting.
That was a very pleasant surprise. And they do a lot of, yeah, I'm with you on seeing their Batgirl movie, man. Because, like, there's a lot of unique, they do some of it in the first Bad Boys movie, in Bad Boys 3. These neat camera tricks.
Yes, the using drones in the way that they should be used.
Yeah,
like really wild, chaotic, like almost like they learned from Bay, but they learned how to do Bay stuff, but they bringing their own kind of clarity to it. It's like, it's weird because I'm with you on that too. Like, the whole style of it all is wild. The swing cameras, the free-floating cameras. Is that what you're talking about? That's what you're talking about, right?
All of it. Like, that, there's this really cool camera trick they do with the guns where the camera is like, mounted, so it's first person, but then it flips. So you're seeing them, and then it flips back, so you're seeing what they're seeing. Like, it's really, really unique. And, like, they have a good eye for stuff like that. And it's just a damn shame that, and yeah, like, it's like they made an $80 million Batgirl movie that Warner Brothers says was not good. And, like, watching this, like, I refuse to believe it wasn't at least entertaining. You know what I mean? Yeah.
No, absolutely. That's fucking Zaz for you. Like it just, it doesn't make sense to me. Like, it really doesn't. Like seeing, okay, I've also seen their low budget work, like their work that they've done in the Middle East. And, like, I mean, we've seen their work in fucking, in Miss Marvel. Like,
yeah.
I don't see anything that would lead me to believe that at the least, their Batgirl movie is, like you said, entertaining. And at its best, it's low-key. It's like low-key great. You know, there is one thing, like, the instant, like Justice for Reggie, right? Like, this kid that we've seen since Bad Boys 2, where, like, the most troubling scene of this, like, you know, of this, of Bad Boys 2, which is, like, you know, they literally abuse this fucking kid and threaten fucking death and murder of this kid. It, like, you know, and I'll say it, back in 04, I guess it was, or was it 02? That was fucking funny. Like, that made everybody laugh. Like, I remember seeing that in a crowded house on a Friday night. That shit brought the house down, right? But you look at it, and man, they just treated him shitty from the start and until the end. To have the script flipped because he was a Marine, like, he was a Marine in the next one, like, he wanted to become, like, it was weird because it was like he was talking about how he wanted to become a Marine when he was a kid, and then he becomes one. Like, I now want them to do the Reggie side story, like the Reggie as a Marine, like in the Middle East, like they did their other, like, low budget movies. Like, make a $5 million Reggie movie that nobody knows about, and then just bring it out. Like, I don't know what you would call it, Bad Boys and like Reggie, the Bad Boy story, and just unleash a fucking cool ass little movie for him. Because if you're gonna do the thing of, like, expanding the universe, I guess this is kind of like, would it be the introduction of a new character? Like, it all services as, it almost feels like when you watch the movie, like, Vanessa Hudgens, Alexander Ludwig, and even Reggie, they all have their small, like, action beat moments, which makes me feel like this is just starting, because they're going to end up having these people back, because Ludwig and Hudgens, I mean, they're minor stars in their own right, right? Reggie is not. The guy who plays Reggie, Donald, what's his name? Oh, good grief, I can't even think of his name. Dennis McDonald.
Yeah.
He's not a star. I mean, he just starred in these Bad Boy movies. He's never been in anything else. And so it's like, it's not a weird surprise. It's like the best kind of surprise. But I don't know. Like, I feel like if they are going to expand, these characters are interesting enough to me to where I'm just like, yeah, I want to see it. As long as Adil and Bilal direct it, though. Like, I don't want anybody else directing them. Because it just feels like their style is now Bad Boys. Like, the Bad Boy style is them, and they are the Bad Boy style, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I agree with you. I just don't know if I honestly don't know if I want any more in this universe. Like, I don't.
Or you don't want Will Smith.
Yeah, and I hate to say that, because, like, I think their chemistry is still really solid. It's just, I don't know, it was really difficult for me to watch him. It feels so disingenuous, I think, now. I don't know what it, you know, it, maybe I'll come back around, but, yeah, I do... I don't know whether to appreciate that they built Martin Lawrence slapping the shit out of him in this movie, or if to just be like, okay. But, you know, like, I guess they had to do it, you know? Like, he's having these panic attacks, and Martin Lawrence is just like, you gotta snap out of it, Mike, and just smacks the shit out of him, you know? So, yeah, you know, I guess it had to be done. Anyway, yeah, it was still a fun time. I'm glad for them that it's making money. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll see what happens from here. I can't imagine that by the end of the year, they're not like, oh, we're going to do a Bad Boys 5. So,
yeah,
I mean... It's fucking weird that we now have as many Bad Boys movies as we did Lethal Weapon movies.
Oh, man. Okay, like, we do have to talk about that. Like, you've heard...
I don't know that it's ever actually... Like, they've been talking about Lethal Weapon 5 for so long now.
They really have.
And, like... I don't know. It's David Zaslav. So, yeah, he might green light it and let Mel Gibson direct it, so... It's, I mean, whatever.
And here's the dirty secret about Mel Gibson, is that he is still a part of, like, he is still a viable director in Hollywood. Like, I don't think that people, like, I don't think that, like the woke people that think that they canceled him understand that he is still a factor. Like, even a couple of years, I mean, well, it's been 5 years since Forrest Gump went to Vietnam. What's that movie? I can't even think of that movie. Heartbreak Ridge. But I mean, people forget he was nominated for a Best Director again. It was a Best Picture. Andrew, I think it. God, what's his name? Not Andrew McCarthy. Now I can't only get Andrew. Jesus, I love him too.
Garfield.
Yeah, Andrew Garfield. Andrew Garfield was nominated, I think, for Heartbreak Ridge or whatever it's called. So he's still viable. So like you know, the people that are like, oh, well, it's not going to happen. No, it probably will. And especially if Danny Glover is on board, they're going to do it because, you know, it's Lethal Weapon 5. It'll make at least a little bit of money because boomers and Gen X, man, we grew up with Lethal Weapon. We grew up with Mel Gibson. You know, a lot of us are still like our generation are still fans. I mean, boomers, shit, they never stopped loving him, right? Like you know, they go see everything that he does. But you know, it's weird that the series that inspired this series has more movies now than will have more movies than the original that original series. You know, but again, I feel like they've pivoted so, like, it's so clear to me that they've pivoted from away from the Lethal Weapon aspect of it and have gone into the Fast and Furious territory. I mean, this is a fucking movie that at the end, one of the bad guys is killed by an albino alligator. If that is not a sign of the change, just watch the first 10 minutes where Heaven Exists and you know, a parrot and Joe Pantoliano as a character who died in the last movie, which I'm going to tell you, if they make a 5, I guarantee you he comes back because they want to have the Rhea Seahorn of it all reunion in
emotion. Yeah, like I don't know how they're going to manage him coming back again.
Yeah. You know, well, they already started the telenovela redemption arc for Will Smith's son who killed him.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. So I rewatched For Life right before I saw this movie. Like, literally, I was watching it the morning that I saw the sequel of Ride or Die. And there is a moment in that movie where he dies and then they cut to his son and his son looks as shocked as everybody else is that the captain is dead. So I'm fairly certain they've embedded it so that they can have this weird ass, like, he's actually alive and he's been doing undercover work for a global terror, like, you know, for the CIA, and they want them to join because it's really a worldwide issue. Bad Boys in Space. Coming soon, you motherfuckers.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, like, when I saw that, when I saw the death thing, I was like, are you fucking kidding? No, it's because they're learning the lessons from the Fast and Furious. I guarantee you there is going to be...
You can find a way to bring him back. Like, what? Yeah. Nobody will care. Just, you know.
Yeah. And then
gloss over some shit.
And how much you want to bet they're going to get another actor like a John Cena or a Jason Momoa to show up in this shit as like some guy who's tracking them down.
Idris Elba.
Shit.
He's already got a place in the Fast and Furious world. So I don't know. We'll see.
This series has taken so many people that you could honestly pull from them and like steal somebody and it'd be okay, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's true.
But like, I guarantee you guys, Bad Boys in Space is coming just as much as Fast and Furious in Space happened.
All right. Go check out, well, there's not much else going on over at xwingfiles.com. All my other co-hosts have children and lives and no time to podcast. So, but you can check out xwingfiles.com, or you can check out my writing, and more importantly, Adam's writing over at his site.
That is themovieisle.com. You can read Logan's article about St. Elmo's Fire before you watch Bratz, which I would recommend doing that, not just because we like the hits, but because it's actually a great article and it kind of gives you some context. You can read his article about The Breakfast Club, another great
book. I wrote about both of those.
Yes. And so you have some context there. It's kind of great. I've got a bunch of stuff on there. A bunch of reviews this week. Watched a bunch of movies that are out right now that I reviewed. Some good, some bad. But we'll be back next week. Are we gonna go and do the Costner first of the four part Horizon and American Saga?
I have zero interest in it.
That does not bode well for Kevin Costner. So no, we will not be doing that, guys. I will get up and down on my ass and watch The Boys so we can actually have that discussion. Because I'm really wanting to dive into it. I just haven't had a chance. And with four episodes,
time you catch up.
Oh shit, that's right. Five. So we can have that actual big conversation next week about that. And whatever the hell else we've got, who the hell else knows what we're going to be talking about, because we're going to be watching stuff. That's for sure.
I would be. So Orphan Black Echoes does start this week.
That is true.
It's on AMC. I'm not sure how it's airing on AMC. If it's on like the AMC Plus or like, all of that shit. Plus, in 5 days, all of The Bear season 3 drops.
Yes. To which, oh man. Okay. So why don't we make a deal? Why don't we put a pin in The Bear for a couple of weeks? Because I'm going to tell you, that shit's hard to watch 2 episodes in a row, let alone binge that. And if you do binge it, I don't know, man. That's an exercise in some anxiety that I don't know if I have. I mean, what is your thought? Because, I mean, you just recently kind of binged The Bear, didn't you?
Yeah, more or less. By the time I got about 2 or 3 episodes into season 2, I was just in it, and I just blew straight through it. My plan, weirdly enough, The Bear season 3 and that 90s show, the That 70s mm-hmm. Show spinoff, both drop on the same day. So my plan for, they both drop Thursday. So my plan mm-hmm. for next Friday is probably to hang out at the house and watch an episode of The Bear, then watch an episode of the 90s show.
Oh, go back and forth. have your scotch, have a sip of your scotch, and then have a sip of your soda.
Scotch, yeah,
soda. Not put them together as much as making a palate cleanse. Okay. Right.
So that maybe I don't fall into like some deep dark hole that The Bear would probably put me in. I doubt I'll get through either one by the time we talk Saturday, because it'll be Friday before I can watch them. But I will be watching The Boys and The Acolyte as well. So
yes, I will definitely be doing
this. So. But, all right. Yeah, until next week. We'll see you guys soon.
Catch you guys soon. Number 3, Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. Number 4, Mario. Number 5, Weird Al. Number 6, Batman. Number 7, Kal-El. Number 8, The Simpsons. Number 9, TV. Number 10, every single band that I stole all their MP3s. But before they all sold out, say it all together if you're with me now. Nerds ruin everything.